This is part one of our conversation with Dr. Ben Zwiebelson. We look forward to you joining us for part two next episode.
You can still use theories that don't work that well tied to models that might not be useful into methods that are clumsy or clunky or insufficient, and you still can be successful in war.
Greetings and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war. I'm Major Josh Bedingfield, here alongside Majors Kelsey Kurtz and Dan Warner. We'll be your hosts today. Our guest today is the director of U.S. Spacecom's Strategic Innovation Group, Dr. Ben Zwiebelson. While Ben is a government employee and retired Army officer now working for a combatant commander during his day job, we would like to stress that he is appearing on this podcast as a civilian academic. Any views or positions offered are entirely his own and do not in any way represent any official or formal position by U.S. Spacecom, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Dr. Zwiebelson holds a doctorate in philosophy from Lancaster University in the United Kingdom and three master's degrees from Louisiana State University, the Air Command and Staff College, and the School of Advanced Military Studies, of which he is a 2011 graduate. He served in the Army as an infantry officer with multiple deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, spent 7 years after retirement from the Army running design programs and education for U.S. SOCOM at the Joint Special Operations University, and is the author of the book Understanding the Military Design Movement, War, Change, and Innovation, that is available for Rutledge, Amazon, and other booksellers worldwide. Welcome to the show, sir. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Josh, and I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so fun fact for you that I did not share during the pre-recording where we were getting to know each other is that while you were at JSOW, I actually went through your design course as a student.
No way.
And yeah, very small world. I read some of your work while at SAMS, and our mutual friend Duncan Moore, when he pieced you back together to that job, I was like, oh, I went through that course.
Well, you know, there's an insurgency brewing, and I like to be, you know, one of the people mixed up in it. But it's awesome to always run into folks, particularly those that are able to go into programs like SAMS or advanced studies. And, you know, these types of things attract a certain type of curiosity, which is it's essential for all the military. It truly is, which is, I guess, why we're here.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad that you self-described yourself as an insurgent, because those who know you refer to you as a design insurgent. So for those of us here on the crew, I mean, Dan certainly is an insurgent for wargaming. I'm just an insurgent for rabble rousing. And Kelsey's an insurgent within the strategic community from just having such a big brain. I mean, I'm describing them. But
fantastic.
So you write about a ton of stuff. You're a prolific author. You're a noted contributor to the theory of design and the concept and phenomena of design. But we're going to talk today about one of the most contentious and ever-present tools of operational art planners engage with, center of gravity. Seated by Clausewitz, it remains a fixture of how military leaders attempt to frame, understand, and act within complex systems. And potentially, unfortunately, practically speaking, it also lacks practical value and often results in more confusion rather than a greater shared understanding. So let's talk center of gravity. We'll start off by asking you why center of gravity might find its way onto the short list of tools of the operational artist.
All right, and this is a great topic. There's so much to cover on centers of gravity, and I don't want people to think that this podcast is going to be negative, where we're just poo-pooing it and saying it's not worth anything, because it is. The problem is that heroin is useful in small doses as well, but the military overall, we are so infatuated and overdone. Not just this concept, but a lot of other things, but those are future podcasts, right? Levels of war are also not real. But centers of gravity occupy a really unique niche in the identity of our American military, as well as, I would argue, the Western industrialized world writ large, the Anglosphere, some will call it, but also NATO, most of Europe, and everywhere that the Anglosphere has had significant influence over the last several hundred years, particularly in the 20th century. But here's the thing about COGS, is that whether they're good or bad, whether you believe in them or not, it's a tool, it's a cognitive tool that our institution uses, but we are generally unable to let go of the tool for several reasons. One, we don't understand how the tool works in our framework. Some people have stated that COG is a theory. Others say it's a methodology. Some people argue that it's a process. Some people argue that it's a model. And these are important distinctions. But secondly, the institution has made this Jenga stack of everything that we believe, from the philosophical to the micro-tactical, that has this centralized hierarchy, or COG, if you will, that if you pull some of the central pieces out from the bottom, the entire Jenga collapses. And so even if there's a discussion on augmenting or modifying or replacing the COG, the argument turns into, well, if we do that, we're going to lose everything, so we can't do this, we're going to do nothing. And I have that problem with end states and goals as well. So what I mean by being able to drop our tools, I'll throw a couple of metaphors at you. But first, I think there's a distinction that needs to be made on what is a theory, what is a model, and what is a method. These things exist within our social paradigms, our frames for war. And tied to that is our belief systems, our values, and then all of our terminology and language and metaphoric devices all stem from trying to articulate select theories that we believe in, that we espouse, and then we pair them with models. And then between theories and models, that's what generates our methodologies. So MDMP, the Joint Planning Process, MCPP for the Marines, NATO OPP, all these different constructs, these are methods, but they rely upon theories and models. So what's the difference between a theory and a model? And this gets back to the problem with COGS. So when you look at atomic theory, right? In the 20th century, Bohm came up with the formula, the mathematics, and the theory that was trying to explain how all the particles in the universe function. So the formulas that he presented gained ground for a while, and he used a model. And the model was, look, here's all the dense theory that the mathematicians and the physicists are going to go crazy on, but how do we explain to the lay people what this all really means? So he used models. And he used the model of the solar system and said the nucleus, which is composed of neutrons and protons, has electrons orbiting around it just like the planets orbit the sun. So fast forward, a couple decades later, physicists, unfortunately, because they're buzzkill, but they're doing science and not pseudoscience, which we'll get back to later on what the military does, because we don't do science. They are doing actual science, and they said, look, we've found a whole bunch of particles that don't follow your theory. Doesn't work. And so they came up with new theories that replaced Bohm's original theory, and those are superior. Those are the ones that are used today in atomic physics and quantum physics and all these things. But they kept the model. They still use the solar system as the model to explain the denser math and theory, right? So theories with models help employ or help us do methods like MDMP. And sometimes our theories don't work, so we got to get rid of them and add in new theories. And sometimes the models don't work, but the theory's good. So you get rid of the model, which is what doctrine is very good at. We're always changing up our graphics. And they put new models in. Spectrum of war. No, not now. It's a gray zone. No, now it's a continuum. No, now it's a theory of success. Wait, theory of victory. Wait, someone needs another meritorious service medal. Change it again. But you can change models or you can change theories, and both of those impact your methods. But what I'm saying here with COGS is that when Clausewitz is granted credit for bringing about centers of gravity, and I'll say a whole other podcast could be dedicated to where COG-like essence is found throughout all of history, going back into Greek natural philosophy, Machiavelli, and you can go all the way over into Eastern philosophy and other places. But Clausewitz gets the brass ring, and I don't want my front door smashed down by the Dead Carl Club with their torches and pitchforks. So, okay, Clausewitz invented Schwerpunk, but he took the model from natural physics, Newtonian gravity, right? Except he stripped away all the theory. We don't use Newtonian physics in how we do COGS. If you show mathematical theory of physics or theory of gravity to our strategic planners, they'll look at you like, what? And if you took our planners and took their center of gravity analysis, whether you use Strange, Irons, Eichmeier, Echeverria, Iron, Riley, Chem, like they're all there, right? And you bring those over to NASA and say, hey, we want you to apply these to the latest Hubble images that are studying the black hole over there that uses gravity. They're going to look at you like, what? Right? Because those are different theories, but they're sharing a similar model to help people kind of explain and understand it so they can apply it to a method. So when Clausewitz did that, or his editor or his wife, what theory did he put in there? And this is what we need to get to. Centers of gravity are not scientific. Centers of gravity are ascientific, or as Christopher Paperone says in his work, pseudoscientific. And what I mean by that is that we're drawing from a much longer military history that goes back into the feudal age, goes back into antiquity, goes back into where myths and legends are intermingled with ascientific ideas so that we can make sense of how we go about doing warfare in a way that's reliable, regulatory, uniform, that we can build upon it. And this all happened around the world, and this is how our species was able to do amazing things, like build the pyramids. But we didn't do it with science, because natural science didn't exist until a European backwaters group suddenly came up with a different process, right? And that's really important. That deals with emergence and complexity. But let's go to flat earth really quick, and I'll circle back to COGS, right? Flat earthers, not popular today. Well, I sometimes view people that just talk nonstop about centers of gravity as flat earthers. I can't change their minds. They're going to be that way until they die. Just let them believe it. It makes them feel good. It doesn't hurt anybody, right? And the funny thing is, when military professionals follow the cog and apply it in our planning, sometimes things actually do work out. And the flat earther goes, see, I told you the earth was flat, right? And so it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy. But let's go to flat earthers, right? Alexander the Great, great warrior, right, Josh? Great military leader, flat earther.
I'm not going to walk into your trap.
Okay. Or what about Hannibal? And I'm not talking about the guy from the A-Team. I'm talking about Carthage, all right? Or we could go to, they're both great. Maybe George Pappard was a flat earther. That's another podcast. But let's go to Genghis Khan. Let's go to Richard the Lionheart, right? All of these people probably were flat earthers. Did it matter in their military campaigns? Not at all, right? Because you can still use theories that don't work that well tied to models that might not be useful into methods that are clumsy or clunky or insufficient. And you still can be successful in war, because war is so much more than some sort of micromanaged little watch that you can wind forwards and backwards, right? And most of us agree with that. For the last several centuries, people have been arguing beyond Jomini that you can't wind and unwind something as complex as warfare. And that, to his credit, is what Clausewitz's book really argues. That's the most important thing of Clausewitz, is combining German Romanticism as a rejection to this Enlightenment positivism that Vauban and Jomini and others were trying to advocate all the way through. He was explaining Napoleon in a really important way that brought in what was going on with the rise of the Westphalian nation state. But we focus in on Schwerpunk because we want a paint-by-numbers formula to give us a model so that we can validate the theory so we can do our methods in Westphalian total nation state warfare. So let's go back to flat earthers. So cogs are like flat earthing. It doesn't matter until it matters. So now we're in a world where the world's round, and we've understood this for a long time. And multiple wars, including World War I and World War II, had to be fought by military thinkers and leaders that didn't have a flat earth perspective, they had a round earth perspective. And we use centers of gravity. Now, there's a lot of historical details there, but we're doing broad brush here, right? What is important now is the world changing? And to go from flat earth to round earth, let's go to digital Pangea, where we are today. And this digital Pangea exists over that original round earth that also has a flat earth lurking in it. And on top of the digital Pangea, where we're all connected with technology and social media and information and data and soon artificial intelligence, certainly, there's a socially constructed layer that's even thicker that's on top. And that's where war intersects on all those things. And so where we're going and how these things are changing are challenging the cognitive tools that we use. And so the center of gravity is present on the short list of tools in operational art, your question, because we can't let go of this Newtonian mindset that was really established several centuries ago, and it peaked before World War One, and a lot of historians and theorists such as Anatole Rapoport argue that, yeah, and Little Hart, that, and Fuller, F.C. Fuller says that, you know, World War One was where we screwed up because we kept trying to do this Napoleonic stuff and it got away from us. But nonetheless, cogs have endured because we are not willing to change our war paradigm and adapt complexity theory, quantum, postmodernism, social paradigms or sociology. We're not accepting any of that because we're still grounded in the Napoleonic style. We just assimilate the words and strip away the theory and take the models that we like and slam them in. So I'll pause there because I know I've gone way over on that question.
I am stuck right now on this concept. We've had it come up before in a previous conversation with another guest about how, you know, some models, all models are useless, but some are potentially useful. And I'm just fascinated with this concept that the premise of COG being a theory of gravitational pull and sources of fixing glue that Clausewitz encountered in his observations of the Napoleonic Wars is just no longer relevant, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, given the context of the increasingly complex systems that we find ourselves in today. Would that be a fair characterization of kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. And the problem is that we're not scientific, even though we insist we are. We say that doctrine is academically sound and scientifically proven, and all those are just flat out lies. Those are just absolute lies. I would offer that at Leavenworth tonight, just go over to ILE, knock on the door, and tell those majors to pile up all the doctrine you've got at the operational and strategic level. The tactical is okay, but especially FM3O, the newest one, just pile them up and burn them, right? Because you're not burning books. You're burning ideology. You're burning something that's not scientific nor even rigorously academic, right? These are completely divorced from reality. Doctrine comes from our history, particularly in the Middle Ages, but also going back into Roman and Greek antiquity, into ideologies and religious structures that were coincidentally hierarchies, and used constructs such as trinities and other geometric constructs that would work with not a scientific understanding of, say, gravity, but a rationalized ascientific construct that we've shackled together through a series of different hodgepodge beliefs that we then institutionalize. And I'll offer you this. How great would it be if our COG theory could work to where we could say that there's an event horizon that we need to consider in warfare, and that you have to do that as part of the joint planning process? You know what an event horizon is in real physics, right?
I mean, other than the fantastic Lawrence Fishburne movie.
Oh, no. That.
I'm not a NASA scientist. So
I haven't seen better acting since Pee Wee's Playhouse with Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah, no, it's a seminal horror film.
So think about that. Like, when we look at actual science, you know, not the stuff that's in doctrine, not the stuff that joint planning and the MDMP is based on. When we look at real science and we say, okay, scientists are able to go and they're studying black holes, they're looking at this thing that's an event horizon. It's a fascinating concept that once you pass it, you're breaking the laws of the universe because of what's happening. And it's all theoretical. It's all theoretical, right? So it's not proven. It's not proven. There's no history there, right? But nonetheless, science is progressing there and saying, like, look, here's all the data and the information. Here's the theory that we're doing. And here's the models that we're using to try to make sense of this. And as we're doing this, we're understanding our universe better. And things like quantum theory are helping us here. And all these things help us, right? And if the existence, so some of the great work on black holes has been rejected in recent years because new theories have come out that have replaced them. And that's the natural progress of science. Now, when you go into a religious organization or the military, this is where we say, no, this is what we do because the doctrine says so, because it was signed by a general and the institution published it. And oh, by the way, this supersedes the last pub, which now you can't talk about. which isn't how any of this works. That's not how academia works, right? But we're an institution that is geared towards what? We're still trying to win and fight in how wars were understood 3 to 8 centuries ago, which is you need to have incredible uniformity, reliability, risk reduction, certainty. You need a stable worldview. And then tied into that becomes the natural science fixation, where not just Clausewitz, but going across all the theorists, they were all from Mahan to Corbett to Duhett to especially Fuller, were drawing and pulling from natural sciences. Fuller writes an entire book. It's beautiful. Wrote it in 1915, and then it was published again in 1925. And Fuller's book is all about, we need to use positivism, which is not your family cheering for you at the football game. That's being positive. Positivism is where we say that the world can be ripped apart, reduced down, and broken into ones and zeros and mathematical measurements and properties. And then once we determine all of the fundamental laws and rules and values and principles, we can reassemble the whole thing. And with enough time, energy, resources, and analysis, we really can predict everything. We can go into your brain and figure out all the neurons that are firing to be able to predetermine your behavior. I mean, that's the extent of positivism. It actually rejects German Romanticism, which is what Clausewitz was trying to bring in. So this thing oscillates back and forth. For some reason, the cog still endures to this day. Crazy, isn't it? Now, the thing that's interesting, though, and this leads into, I think, your next question, is in 1832, if we are to give Clausewitz the brass ring and that no one else thought of cogs before him, or using other terms other than Schwerpunkt, then in 1832, he introduces this concept for warfare, taking it from physics, right? Also in 1832, in remarkably the same part of the world, the collection of Prussian and pre-Germanic states, a biologist pushes a paper and introduces the rhizome in biology. And rhizomes are all around us. They're all over in the world. Potatoes, tubulars, crabgrass, certain starfish that you can chop in half. I mean, that's not technically a rhizome, but it has rhizomic qualities. And these are things that don't have a center. They're the exact opposite of a center of gravity. So for those of you that live down south, like I have in Florida and Fort Polk, for those of you that lived around there, you'll see these trees with Spanish moss. And that's a beautiful example of a centralized hierarchy, a cog, the tree form, coexisting with a rhizome, something that's not a cog. That's the opposite of a cog, but they live symbiotically. And so in 1832, these two concepts came out of the same part of the world, different disciplines. Yet one of them is exclusively used as the only tool for us to conceptualize how war works, and the other doesn't exist. It's not in any of our planning. It's not in any of our doctrines. It's not in any of our discussions. Not at all. We even take rhizomic-like entities, I don't know, drug cartels, the Islamic State, environmental extremist groups, and etc., and then we impose upon them the cog. Why do we do that? Part of it is because we're not scientific here. We are being ideological.
Sir, so I had it. Perfect transition teed up about 3 left turns ago, and somehow we ended right back up into the direction so where we wanted to go. For listeners who are not familiar with Dr. Zwiebelson's work, the themes of geometric formations in natural science occur throughout them as an analogy for the center of gravity. And you published an article that has become a center of the SAMS design curriculum, which is Rhizomes and Paradox to Centers of Gravity and Centralized Hierarchies of War. You went through a definition of what rhizomes were and explained how they work within the ecological system. And your article critiques the use of concept of centers of gravity in military planning. And instead, you advocate for a more organic and networked approach that recognizes the complexity and unpredictability of the modern warfare. Can you, more than so than you've already done, kind of unpack how you see, you know, adversarial systems as a rhizome-based ecological system?
Okay, that's a deep question. So for the audience that are still listening, I'll offer you this. First of all, the great news is that article, I think it's on Medium, that was just a draft. I like to prototype things, but I've got a book coming out, a second book, and this one's coming out through the Air University Press. which means it's going to be free and online and digitally available to everybody. It's going to come out this summer, and the book is called Beyond the Pale, Designing Military Decision-Making Anew. And I'll let you know if you follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn or follow me at Medium. I'll be definitely promoting when that's available. But in there is a more advanced version of what SAMS is using currently, and I'm humbled that they are. And so what I do in there is I basically take how we do the joint planning process. I was aiming at the joint and the interagency and also the NATO level. So I was saying, all right, well, let's take NATO OPP and the joint planning process, because everything else is sort of similar. And I mean, there are nuanced differences, but again, they're not scientific, they're ideological. If they were scientific, then the Marines and the Army would wage an experiment, right, on COGS. And then whichever one was proven in a quantitative or qualitative way, you'd probably have to go qualitative with war, then the other service would admit it and remove it from their doctrine. And what I'm talking about, what is the big COG difference between the Marines and everyone else? Anyone? They believe in tactical centers of gravity.
Well, just for the sake of conversation, Army doctrine also acknowledges that COGS operate at every level of war.
So if you look at what the Army doctrine says, though, on the COGS, we construct them at the operational and the strategic. However, when we are supposed to do, once again, whether you're following Eichmeier, Echeverria, Strange, Chem, Irons, Riley, they're looking at you trying to break the operational COGS down into the tactical, which is a centralized hierarchy and a Newtonian construct. It's not complexity theory. It doesn't work that way because we don't use complexity theory because we're not doing science. But what we're doing there is we're saying that the Army believes and is told to obey that you find critical vulnerabilities or requirements or capabilities, and those things are nested in tactical activities. A series of tactical operations will cumulatively lead to operational effects that then achieve, you know what I'm talking about, right? Campaign design. The Marines, though, are a different culture, right? And they operate differently. You know, they're smaller. They're definitely expositionary. They're out there. They're operating under different conditions. I love, there's a certain line where the Marines have their own Air Force and that their Air Force has their own other Air Force. It's something along the lines of that. It's fascinating. But for them to use tactical center of gravity makes sense. Now, here's what's strange, and it goes back into, not strange in his analysis of COGS, just the word strange. It's not tied to context because, again, we're not scientific, we're ideological, we're institutionalized. Because the Marines are small and they operate forward and they operate remote and they operate under smaller contexts than, say, a Continental Army construct, right? But we have this thing called SOCOM. And inside of SOCOM is USASOC, U.S. Army Special Operations Command. And USASOC has a very, very different special operations mission of sending out special operations, ODAs, and they tend to do either irregular or even unconventional warfare. So unconventional warfare, you've got a small ODA that's completely out by itself in the wilderness. But what does its Army doctrine tell it must be followed? There are no tactical COGS. Don't do them. And right next to them is a Marine Force Recon doing tactical COGS. So again, if we were scientific, we'd be testing all this stuff and validating it. But this goes back to the whole, this is ideological. So this brings in Kelsey's question of rhizomes. And how could we use rhizomes? So for the audience that might not be familiar with this, it's a really important concept because it's all around us. And the key thing about rhizomes is that there's a postmodern adaptation of the biology, and that happened in the mid-20th century. And then that's the roundabout way that it got into military design. Because Shimon Nabe, the father of Israeli design, which is the father of all military design, fused in complexity theory, systems thinking, and postmodernism, among other things. And so he was drawing from the postmodern construct, not the biological. So this goes back to my comments about theories and models and how we kind of pick and choose them and then pop them into our new methods. So design is a method too, but design uses different theories and models and constructs and language. And there's also, I think, a much more critical and creative awareness on when you're doing design versus planning. It's just shut up and color, unfortunately. And it's non-reflective, which is why we don't understand that we do the things that we do. We don't understand why we use COGS. It's just because this is what we're supposed to do, and we better do it, or higher headquarters is going to get mad. So rhizomes are important because They are something that doesn't have the cog quality of that we can target something, that we can isolate it, that we can, if you look at a tree, if you chop a branch off, everything above the branch dies. That forms the philosophical basis of things such as the effects-based operations, which is looking not at simple systems and not complex systems, but as Gurang Ganji, complexity theorist who was mentored under Russell Acuff, another incredible complexity theorist, Gurang Ganji says, look, that's a uni-minded system. It means that there's one brain that controls everything. So just like if you had your head cut off, your whole body would not work. A tree with its root or trunk removed is limited. If you target the barracks of the Iraqi fighter pilots, they ain't going to fly, right? The planes aren't going to fly, right? So that's where effects-based operation works. And where it doesn't work is where things in reality or how the world is operating in the context that you're in don't obey a centralized hierarchy or a tree form or a cog construct. And so you have to get into, okay, well, what are some examples of this? Where is this sort of thing happening? Well, it's happening all around you at all levels, from the micro-tactical all the way up into the strategic, depending upon the context. But a lot of these things are going to occur particularly in how human beings socialize. We do socialize in centralized hierarchies all the time. Corporations work that way. We have the president of the United States. We have the elder father of a family clan who's, you know, whenever they show up for the dinner table at Thanksgiving, they have to cut the turkey. These are centralized hierarchies, and they're fine. But in mixed in there are rhizomic constructs that are completely ignored in the joint planning process and our strategy, which is, I would say, problematic.
This has been part one of our conversation with Dr. Ben Zwiebelson on center of gravity analysis. For part two, please join us again next episode. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by following us on Twitter at US_SAMS. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or otherwise would like to engage with us, feel free to email us at operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.